And welcome back to Current State. I'm Joe Lindstroth, sitting in for Mr. Mark Bayshore today. It's Wednesday, September 25th. We have a nice variety on the show for you today. Neighbors in Action, it's Wednesday, will feature WKAR's very own radio reader service, which turns 40 next week. We'll also preview the one-man play Beethoven and Misfortune Cookies, which is just showing tomorrow night at the Wharton Center. And we'll discuss the unprecedented diplomatic opening with Iran, that General Assembly speeches by President Obama and Iranian President yesterday. But first, Michigan Democrats are pinning their hopes on a former state lawmaker to unseat Republican incumbent Tim Walberg in the 7th Congressional District next year. Pam Burns is a former state rep and House Speaker pro tem from Chelsea. She's an attorney and a small business owner. Most recently, she's been living in China as the executive director of the University of Michigan Shanghai Jiao Tong University Joint Institute. Announcing her candidacy back in July, she said, quote, "Washington is broken, and Tim Walberg is part of the problem. He puts special interests and corporations ahead of middle-class Michigan families." Pam Burns is here in the studio to discuss her candidacy. Welcome to Current State, Pam.
Thank you. Good morning. Pleasure to be here.
Well, I have to come out guns a-blazing here.
Okay.
I think Congress is polling perhaps worse than dogfighting endodontists right now.
And
we haven't even gotten to the fiscal cliff and the possible shutdown.
I know.
Why on earth would you want to join one of the least popular, most vilified groups in America?
Well, I've always liked challenges. There's no doubt about it. You know, I was a friend of the court, a road commissioner, and these were not popular jobs either, and I did family law. So maybe I like the challenge. Maybe I want to be able to help people. And so that's why I decided to run.
When you announced your candidacy back in July, you criticized Tim Walberg, as I mentioned, as part of the reason Washington is broken, and accused him of partisan politics that pushed special interests and corporations before working families. How has he done that exactly?
Well, I think his voting record has proven that. But also, what I'm about is bringing the people to the table and finding solutions to the problem, not taking a certain stance and then just saying no to everything. I think that tends to be more negative. I'd like to be more positive and try and move things forward.
So you're looking at the word might be compromise.
Well, I like to say solution.
Okay.
Because that's what we need to be doing. I think people are, and I think this is what the polling has shown, that the people are really fed up with the gridlock that's in Washington. And part of that is because people are not listening to each other. They're not trying to work together. You know, when I was the Speaker pro tem, I changed the table in my office from a large rectangular one to a round one.
I read that.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yes.
Well, yeah. And that's because that way you're all facing each other and you're trying to work things out.
So tell us why you're different. How will voters know that you won't just replace one kind of partisan politics with another?
I think you have to look at the track record. Again, Mr. Walberg has a record of saying no. He was known as Mr. No when he was in the state legislature. And it's been pretty much the same thing. I mean, 40 plus some votes to repeal Obamacare. You know, that's not moving our country forward. So I think what my track record is working in a bipartisan fashion, if there are people on the other side of the aisle willing to do that, and to find the solutions. There has always got to be common ground with people.
What issues will you be focusing on in your campaign?
Foremost in my mind is agriculture and transportation. Agriculture, because we have got a very rich agricultural base here. And having spent some time overseas, I know that the people there want our product. We have got quality products here, and we had to find a way to get our products over there. And transportation. As you know, I was chair of transportation committee when I was in the House and was a road commissioner. So I have a real understanding of the need for supporting our infrastructure. We need it for, you know, the economy. It's dependent upon having a sustainable infrastructure.
Regarding agriculture, do you care to comment on the farm bill volleying back and forth and what's going on in Congress right now?
Well, it's my understanding that the SNAP funding was cut by the Republicans, which is, I believe, $40 billion of aid to people who really need it. And this is the first time this has been done. And I don't think that's very responsible at all.
Tim Walberg's been elected three times now from the 7th District. And the district's been redrawn to favor Republicans even more since he beat Kurt Haskell last year. What's your plan to win the district?
Well, I don't necessarily agree with what those statistics are. First of all, when Mark Schauer lost in 2010, it was by a very slim vote. In 2010, as we know, it was a horrible year for Democrats. And I don't know Mr. Haskell, but I don't think there was a really strong campaign. And even with
he
that,
he was outspent 10-1.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think the point is that the base, it may be slightly Republican, but when I first ran for the state house in Washtenaw County, the western part of Washtenaw County, I had the same numbers, but I was able to attract the independent voters, the moderate Republicans, and I believe I'm going to be able to do that again.
Can you reveal a little of your strategy? Where are your anchors in the district? Where are you kind of focusing your energy? Where do you think, anyway?
Well, as I started my seven-county swing a couple weeks ago, we went to every single county. We had met a lot of people at the different coffee houses around the district. And just listening to people, I think they want somebody to listen to them. I have gotten the understanding after this tour and talking with people that the current representative is really not being a representative. And I think that's the foremost function of this position.
You're listening to Current State on WKAR. I'm Joe Lindstroth, sitting in for Mark Bayshore today, speaking with Pam Burns. She's a former state rep and House Speaker pro tem and is currently the Democratic candidate for Congress in Michigan's 7th District. You spent some years in Lansing, as I just mentioned.
I did. But
you've also recently said that name recognition is one of your biggest problems. How are you overcoming that?
Well, I'm just getting started, obviously. I've only
right.
been on the campaign
yeah.
trail for a little bit less than 3 months, 2.5 months. So what we will be doing is going out more and more into the districts, into the counties, and meeting with the people. So, it's just one-on-one and, meet and greets and getting to know the people, going to Farm Bureau meetings, going to chamber meetings, letting people know who I am.
What accomplishments while you were in the state legislature are you most proud of? Do you
there's several of them. One is the chair of transportation. I was able to nurture through the Aerotropolis legislation, which had to do with the economic development around Willow Run and Detroit Metro airports for increased economic development there. Also, I worked across the aisle to develop and pass the cottage food bill. The cottage food bill allows small entrepreneurs and people to go to farm markets and sell their products, certain products, without having to go through a certified kitchen. So that was a major accomplishment. When I go around to farm markets now and I tell them, I helped, with this farm, the cottage food bill, they just couldn't thank me enough because it's helped them a lot. It brings extra money to the families that need it.
I think there's one vote I want to talk to you about that maybe some folks on both sides haven't forgotten. You were one of 14 Democrats back in 2010 who joined the House Republicans in a vote to pass legislation which increased teacher requirement premiums and removed any guarantee of retirement health benefits. Care to address that decision? There was some fuzziness
I certainly remember.
Political
and
action committee getting
involved. As I recall, it was to have the teachers put 3% into a health care trust. And I think now they're paying 20%, I believe. I've been out of the country, but that's my understanding. So I think maybe we were just a little ahead of our time.
So you haven't been getting any flack so far since you've been back on the campaign?
Oh, no, okay. Not at all, because they realized that was just a little hiccup. But and I do want to just take this opportunity to say that I have listened to Current State from its very beginning when I was in China because of the time difference.
I'm blushing.
Yeah, well, because when you're on 6 o'clock in the evening here, it's 6 a.m. over there. So as I'm getting ready for work, I'm listening to Current State all the time. It's great. Just really enjoyed it.
I want to get into your time working in China.
Yeah.
Briefly, we only have a few minutes left. But what lessons will you take to Washington from your experience in Shanghai?
The importance of the American economy and how we need to make sure that we remain the leaders in the world. And that's where I think about the infrastructure. And that's where I realized that we need to be dealing with these other issues that are going on, that the world looks at our Congress, and we have a reputation to uphold. And that's what I'm bringing.
President Obama, according to commentators across the spectrum, it has been struggling. We can argue to what level. What do you make of the administration's woes or the issues that President Obama's been dealing with?
Well, you know, I believe that what's happened is that the Republicans have become so bitter that their agenda is all targeted at the president. This whole thing about rejecting Obamacare and everything is try to discredit him. And in the meantime, our economy is suffering, the middle class is suffering, and we need to be paying attention to job growth rather than trying to attack the president.
Real quick, just a little bit of your history. I think it's really interesting. You grew up. You grew up as a Republican.
I
Republican
did.
Household.
I did.
You had Republican parents. You were Republican yourself as a young person.
Yeah.
What influenced the evolution of your political beliefs?
Oh, I think the Vietnam War, Kent State. I just remember when Kent State happened, which was way before your time, but it was very relevant to me at the time. And just the evolution. I was a Rockefeller girl growing up. But if you brought Rockefeller back now with his beliefs, they would be extremely liberal in the Republican camp. And I don't even think you'd be welcome in the Republican camp. But he was a person who cared about his state. He cared about the people with that safety network. And he was very progressive.
And lastly, we just have less than a minute, and this is a big question, but, you know, middle class has been talked about a lot, the inequality gap.
Right.
If you were to go to Washington, what sort of efforts would you look to address boosting up the middle class here in America?
Education. Number one in my mind is education, and that's the takeaway that I have from being overseas, that there is a strong emphasis and value by the families for education. And we need to be really bolstering our K-12 system with adequate courses in STEM areas. And I really think we should be doing more with foreign languages early on. I think children should be learning Spanish. They should be learning Mandarin. They should be learning French. That should be required.
Well, Pam, we could talk for the whole rest of the show, but it's a long campaign.
Yeah,
we still have over a year, and we do hope to have you back as this campaign goes along. Pam Burns is a former state rep and House Speaker pro tem, and is currently the Democratic candidate, or a Democratic candidate for Congress in Michigan's 7th District. Thank you, Pam, for joining us.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Well, it is Wednesday today, which means it's time for our Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. This week, we feature our very own WKAR's radio reading service, which turns 40 next week. The service offers news and books read by volunteers to visually and physically impaired folks across mid-Michigan. Mike Lipsy has been a volunteer reader for the radio reading service for all 40 years of his existence. That's a long time. And Brad Walker, in addition to his duties, as you've heard, as a local host for All Things Considered, is also current director of the Radio Reading Service. Earlier this week, I spoke with them about the program. Brad says that the volunteers read all sorts of things for the visually and physically impaired users.
We read newspapers, books, short stories. We read the grocery ads. We read shopping advertisements. We have an entertainment program. A lot of different book programs, book shows, interviews with authors, that kind of thing. But it's basically like a full-service station for people who are blind and visually impaired. And it's to get them through the day of what's happening out in the world.
Now, this isn't just something that anyone can tune into on a frequency on their radio. How does it get from the WKR studios into these folks' homes?
We have a specially made radio that has our subcarrier channel. We're on a subcarrier channel off the WKAR FM transmitter. And each person that qualifies for our service receives one of these radios.
Is this filled with content throughout the day, or are there just certain hours in which the visually impaired who are signed up for this can access the content or to expect
we're
that there
on,
will be content?
We're on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and we have something on at any time. We run repeats of some things. So, for example, we'll read the Lansing State Journal at 9 o'clock. We'll read that newspaper. That will air again at 6 o'clock or I'm sorry, 7 o'clock in the evening for those that may have missed it at 9 o'clock. So we operate just like a regular radio station.
Yeah. Now, 40th anniversary coming up here,
wow,
October 1st, the Radio Reading Service. That's pretty amazing, 40 years.
It really is.
Mike Lipsey, you've been a volunteer here for all 40 years.
All 40 years, yes.
And my understanding is it wasn't always known as a Radio Reading Service. What was it back when you started?
I think I answered a short ad in the State Journal when this started up. They were looking for people willing to read for an hour at a time for the Radio Talking Book.
Radio Talking Book,
radio
it was called.
Radio
RTB, perhaps, shortened.
RTB, that's right. And so I had done a little announcing at my dad's AM station before I came to Michigan State and thought this is a neat way to help out people and to sort of keep my hand in front of a microphone. So I applied and was one of the, I forget, seven, eight people who began as volunteer readers.
How old were you at the time?
I was 27. I was an old student. I'd already gotten out of the Army. We were living in University Village at the time, my wife and two children. My son was born that summer. That's how I can keep track of how long the Radio Reading Service has been going.
So you have a 40-year-old son.
That's exactly right. And it started out in the old OD, the University Auditorium, up on the second floor, and that's where the WKAR studios, I think, were on the third floor at the time. But they had renovated some storage closets underneath the balconies, and those were our studios for RTB broadcasts. Not ventilated, fairly dark. Watched your head because of the slope of the balcony above you.
Sounds like some things haven't changed in radio.
And they were hot in the summer, but it was fun.
What sorts of things would you read back then in 1973?
The live programming, I think, was 5 or 6 hours a day, maybe more. And it was largely newspapers. I think grocery ads may have been done then. I cut my teeth on the free press, I think.
Brett, how many listeners are there? How many people participate in the radio reading program currently?
Currently, we have about 800 listeners.
All in the mid-Michigan area.
All in the mid-Michigan area, yep. And volunteer-wise, we're just over 100. I think we're at about 104 volunteers, 105 volunteers. We have some that have their own shift, like Mike. He comes in every Tuesday at 5 o'clock to read the Christian Science Monitor. We have folks like him. We have people that just actually fill in, and we have people that actually just read books and short stories, and they set their own schedule. Usually it's once a week or twice a week, however they choose.
That's what I think is really fascinating. So, Mike, you're focusing in on the Christian Science Monitor. You almost develop an expertise about a publication in a way. I mean, how do you choose what to read as far as which newspapers, which books, which short stories? Do you take requests?
We do take requests. We really haven't received any requests for books or anything like that at this time, but we certainly would do that if somebody wanted to hear a new novel of some sort. We definitely will have a reader that will do something like that. Reading newspaper articles, that is left to the volunteer. We have a format of, 10 minutes of international news, for example, 10 minutes of local news, 10 minutes of sports, and they read mostly the mid-Michigan stuff, sports-wise, your MSU, your U of M, your Detroit teams, that kind of thing. But locally, it's all up to the volunteer on what stories do we have, for one, and what stories they can actually get in 10 minutes.
So there is some autonomy among the volunteers, yes, to decide what you choose to read.
Yeah. You're thinking about sitting down and reading to a friend, and what does the Christian Science Monitor have that's unique to that paper? It's going to be more of a national coverage. If I'm sitting down with the Jackson Citizen Patriot, then we're looking for things more of a local bent and in more detail and more depth than they're liable to just catch as headlines sometimes.
Brad, you've been the director of the Radio Reading Service for 6 years, mm-hmm, now at WKAR. Is there a story that comes to mind that encapsulates the program? In the 6 years that you've been here, have you heard from listeners? Is there something that really gives a sense of why you keep doing this and why we keep doing this as a service at WKAR?
I got this from a listener probably about 3-4 years ago. We had decided at the Radio Reading Service to go out and interview a couple of different listeners and have promos on the air for our FM, for our television promos. And one of them really caught me because of what she said. She's a listener in Okemos. She can see fine, but she has some sort of issue with her hands and her legs and her feet that she doesn't know hot or cold. So she can't really turn a page very well. She just can't do that. So she has our service. And one of the questions, obviously, is what we ask them is, what does radio reading service mean to you? And she said, it's a friend. It's somebody that I can listen to, not necessarily talk to them, but somebody is actually talking to me. And she said, people don't understand that if you're blind or you're not, if you don't have any connection with a friend or anybody like that, it's difficult to go through life. But when I've got somebody that is talking to me, when Mike reads the Christian Science Monitor, he's reading it to me. It gets me through the day. And that just got me. I thought, that's why I'm here. That's why I do this program. I am in charge of this program because of people like her that we're helping. And that makes a big difference in my life, too.
Mike, you've been volunteering at the Radio Reading Service for 40 years, since its inception. That's a deep commitment, one that I think few can claim of any sort, be it marriage, friendship. You know, 40 years is a long time in any sort of commitment. Looking inward for a moment, what has volunteering at the Radio Reading Service meant in your life?
It began, and it still is, an opportunity to do something that for me is easy and enjoyable, that I know, just as Brad was saying, helps people. I have friends who are blind and who I know have tuned in over the years, and I had feedback from them, and that was nice. It's been a good thing to do. As far as the long-term commitment, was it Woody Allen said that 90% of success is just showing up? So when you have a one-hour commitment every week, you just make that. It was an easy and enjoyable way to help people. And I look at a picture here I have of myself 20 years ago when the talking book was 20. A difference in hair color, but it's difficult to think of the time passing like that. I've read with so many people and had so many friendships in the radio talking book, but time passes fast.
It sure does. It sure does. Although the lamps seem to stay the same.
I was noticing that this morning. Nobody can accuse the radio reading service of not being frugal with equipment.
Mike, I have to ask you, in the 40 years of reading news, what's one of the most memorable things you've read into the microphone?
Oh, gosh. That's a tough question. Well, the thing is, I hate to say mundane, because part of this is providing local news that particularly over the years our readers have been able more and more to go to other channels for the big headlines and the world-shaking events. So a lot of our coverage is local. And the things that I remember are the local events in Jackson, local events in Lansing or Flint. That's what we could do.
Brad, for those who are listening out here who would like to participate in the radio reading service, either as a consumer, someone who listens to the volunteers read, or as a volunteer, how do they go about that?
One thing that you do is people that are listening most of the time right now, they may not be blind or visually impaired. They wouldn't use the service, but they know of their mom or dad or aunt and uncle. They know of somebody who, you know what, that's not a bad idea. Maybe they would be interested in that. All they would have to do is get in touch with me. They can email me at bradw@wkar.org. They can call me at any time at 517-884-4746. They can, if they want to be a volunteer, if they think, wow, I wouldn't mind doing what Mike does, just get in touch with me, and we'll go from there. Volunteers go through an audition, a very strict audition process.
just to make sure folks can read okay?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. But if they're interested in the service itself, get in touch with me. Or if they want to be a volunteer, get in touch with me. Same thing.
Mike, we're coming up on the 40th anniversary of both your volunteering and of the radio reading service. As you look ahead, do you see the radio reading service evolving as you've already seen it evolve? Where do you see it kind of going?
That's hard to say with the changes in communication, the changes in print media. Who knows? But I think there will always be a spot for a friend who's willing to sit down and tell you about the local news, tell you what's going on in the world. You can tune to during the day and just listen.
Well, Mike Lipsey is a 40-year volunteer for WKAR's Radio Reading Service, and Brad Walker is a director of the Radio Reading Service here at WKAR. Thank you, gentlemen, both for talking with me.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you.
And we could always use more nominations, and we know there are great people and organizations out there doing excellent work, and we actually count on you to bring them to us. So please help us out. Send us an email with those great nonprofits in the area to currentstate@wkar.org, put Neighbors in Action in the subject line, and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work that they do. Current State on WKAR. I'm Joe Lindstroth, sitting in for Mark Bayshore today. Yesterday, in front of the UN General Assembly, President Obama gave a wide-ranging speech in which he sought to clarify the United States' role and intentions in the conflict-ridden Middle East. By far the most noteworthy revelation was his embrace of a diplomatic opening from Iran, America's longtime adversary.
The roadblocks may prove to be too great, but I firmly believe the diplomatic path must be tested. For while the status quo will only deepen Iran's isolation, Iran's genuine commitment to go down a different path will be good for the region and the world, and will help the Iranian people meet their extraordinary potential in commerce and culture, in science and education.
About 6 hours after Obama's speech, Iran's new president, Hassan Rouhani, addressed the same General Assembly with similar notions of opening diplomatic negotiations with the United States. This follows what has been an unprecedented charm offensive, as many pundits are calling it, by him and other Iranian leaders. With us now to help sort out what this unprecedented diplomatic opening could mean is Mohammed Ayoub. He's an MSU Distinguished Professor Emeritus of International Relations and the author of the upcoming book, Will the Middle East Implode?, which comes out in February. Welcome back to Current State, Mohammed.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
First, put this into perspective for us, if you will. It seems like we haven't heard this kind of public willingness to negotiate out of Iran since the Islamic Revolution in 1979.
Well, that's not exactly true. There have been two or three cases, particularly in the last decade or 12 years, in which there have been opportunities for such openings, which unfortunately didn't get anywhere. The American administration tried a couple of times to get the Iranians to soften their line. But more importantly, and something that is not very well known in the United States, is that first in 2001 and then in 2010, there were clear signals from Tehran that they were willing to negotiate seriously on the nuclear program issue.
Now in 2001, let's just go there. In 2001, the current Iranian foreign minister, Javad Zarif, played a role in helping U.S. in Afghanistan. How did that work?
That's right. In 2001, at the Bonn conference, after the overthrow of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan, there was a meeting of interested parties which decided that Hamid Karzai, who was the American favorite, would take over as the interim president of Afghanistan. The Iranians played a very constructive role. In fact, even before that meeting, during the campaign against the Taliban, the Iranians had facilitated the flow of arms and other aid from the United States to the Northern Alliance, who were also allies of Iran, and in their push to take over Kabul. So they had even made a sort of a military contribution to the campaign. But in Bonn, it was Javad Zarif, who was then deputy foreign minister and the lead negotiator for Iran, who persuaded the constituencies or those groups in Afghanistan that looked up to Iran or were associated with Iran in one way or the other to agree to accept Karzai's nomination to be president. A nomination that had been made by the United States. And in fact, James Dobbins, who was the lead American negotiator at the Bonn conference, made it very clear. He's done it in articles. He's done it in a congressional hearing in 2007 very publicly, that had it not been for Javad Zarif, the Bonn agreement to anoint Hamid Karzai as the president would never have come about. And he gives full credit to Javad Zarif for bringing that about.
And I think it's worth noting that all of this took place prior to President Bush's infamous State of the Union address, where he called Iran part of the axis of evil.
That's right. And that really put the Iranians off, because that was about a month or so after the Bonn conference, where Iran had played, as I said, a very constructive role, that President George W. Bush lumped Iran with Iraq and North Korea as the axis of evil. And that was a signal that the Iranians took as being, you know, they'll be considered a pariah state no matter what they do. And that making up with the United States was really a dream which wasn't going to come out true.
And there was another chance that you mentioned as recently as May 2010. There was a deal brokered, a potential deal brokered by Brazil and Turkey at President Obama's behest that then he ultimately rejected. What happened
That's
there?
That's right. Well, Turkey and Brazil were both members of the Security Council at that time. I wouldn't say it was brokered at the behest of President Obama, but with the blessing direct or indirect of the president.
Behest is a little strong word.
which was an agreement for Iran to ship out much of its enriched uranium, and various other provisions were involved. And both Turkey and Brazil had taken for granted that since they had had signals from Washington that this would be acceptable to the United States, that the deal would go through. But then when the deal was actually on the table, the United States and its allies, its European allies, turned down that deal, which really put off both Brazil and Turkey. And that's why Turkey voted against further sanctions in 2010 against Iran. So that was another potential opportunity that should have been seized upon, but was not.
But was not. And here we are today. And I think it's worth discussing for a second who Hassan Rouhani is, the new Iranian president. On September 4th, he tweeted out a well-wishing to the Jewish population, especially Iranian Jews, wishing them a blessed Rosh Hashanah. That is a stark difference than his predecessor, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who was a pretty vocal Holocaust denier and declined Israel's right to exist, et cetera, et cetera. Who is Rouhani?
Well, Hassan Rouhani is very different from his predecessor, Ahmadinejad. He has always been a very moderate and diplomatic type of person. He has been involved from the very beginning with the Iranian Revolution. So he has good revolutionary credentials on the one hand. On the other, he has believed, and this came through, you know, in his career several times, that an accommodation with the West and with the United States on the nuclear enrichment issue, as well as on the overall relationship with the United States, was in Iran's long-term interest. It's interesting to note that between 2003 and 2005, when Rouhani was the lead Iranian negotiator on the nuclear issue, he had agreed to suspend enrichment. Uranium enrichment in Iran as a confidence-building measure. And he had got the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, to approve it, hoping that there would be adequate or responses from the West to his offer. But apparently what the West had on offer didn't satisfy the Iranians. And in 2005, when Ahmadinejad became the president, Rouhani was sidelined.
Just put out the pasture.
Yeah, so. And the nuclear enrichment process was restarted. It's also interesting that it was Javad Zarif, who we had been talking about, who's now the foreign minister, was one of Rouhani's major colleagues during those negotiations on the nuclear issue. And now, interestingly enough, Rouhani has put him in charge not only of foreign policy, but also of negotiations on the nuclear issue. And on Thursday, which is tomorrow, he'll be meeting with the foreign ministers of the P5+1, including Secretary of State John Kerry, to start that process.
I'm Joe Lindstroth, sitting in for Mark Beshor, discussing Iran with Mohammad Ayoub, Distinguished Professor Emeritus of International Relations here at MSU. I want to move very quickly. We have about 3 minutes left to talk about the myriad ways this could change the landscape in the Middle East. I mean, we could go all day with these, but I want to focus on two. Syria. Iran has been Assad's, one of his premier supporters. They're supporting Hezbollah, which has also been aiding the Assad regime. How would this impact Syria? I imagine Assad is probably a little less confident in his palace today.
I'm sure. Assad would be very nervous about any openings between the United States and Syria. So are the Israelis. So is Netanyahu. It's very clear from the statements made by the Israeli Prime Minister that he is extremely interested, in fact, committed to derailing this process. I mean, he's gone on record publicly after the correspondence, the letter from Obama to President Rouhani and the statements that have been made by both the presidents, that he thinks Rouhani is a fake and that the Americans should not be taken in by it. On the Syrian front, I'm sure that the decision makers in Tehran look at the Syrian issue and the nuclear issue as being interconnected with each other. Now, what they are willing to offer on the nuclear issue and what they would be willing to accept in return on the Syrian issue, nobody really knows. Or the other way around, what they would offer on the Syrian issue if they had a deal on the nuclear enrichment issue as well. But, you know, this is really, as we say, the devil is in the details. And once they get down to the negotiations, this would come out. But I've always argued that the Iranian nuclear issue is not the root cause. The root cause of the problems that exist between Iran and the United States. It's the state of bad relations between the United States and Iran that drive Tehran towards seriously looking at its nuclear option.
They're a lot deeper. The mistrust. The distrust goes back a little longer than that, yeah. Very briefly, I have less than a minute. What does each side have to do to move this forward? Right now it's rhetoric. What sort of action does each side have to take to show the other that we're operating in good faith here?
Well, Rouhani has made clear that it is not in Iran's, as he said, from the perspective of Iran's security interests to possess nuclear weapons, which is far beyond what any of the others negotiators have gone. So that's one thing on the table that should at least.
And the Ayatollah Khamenei issued a fatwa against nuclear weapons.
That's right. That it's not, that it's un-Islamic and should not be a part of the Iranian arsenal. Now, that could be taken as so much talk.
Of course.
Because it is true that given Iran's strategic environment, I'm sure that they're not going to give up the nuclear option totally. But I think they could probably do enough in terms of stopping the nuclear enrichment process or things like that, which would then lead to the lifting of sanctions. But the two must take place simultaneously. I think there should be enough give on the side of the P5+1 for Iran to go any further.
Mohammad Ayoub is an MSU Distinguished Professor Emeritus of International Relations and the author of the upcoming book, Will the Middle East Implode?, which comes out February. Mohammad, we always love having you here on Current State. We will have you back to discuss this and other issues in the Middle East soon. Thank you for joining us.
Well, you're most welcome. I enjoy doing this.
Beethoven and Misfortune Cookies by playwright Joni Ravenna is a one-man show about Caban Thomas, a University of Arkansas music professor who was fired in 2006 for using profanity in the classroom. The play is in Wharton Center's Paysant Theater tomorrow night, just for one single performance. WKAR's Melissa Benmark spoke with the actor-director team responsible for the production. You'll recognize the actor from The Jeffersons and White Men Can't Jump, and the director from the legendary TV series Taxi.
T.J. Castronovo, I'm the director.
Hi, I'm Ernest Harden Jr., and I am the star of this one-man show. And, it, you know, I was one man, so I guess that's me.
So both of you have done considerable film and TV work. People will recognize your names. What prompted the two of you to do this stage play?
Well, we belong to the Actors Studio. He's with the Actors Studio as an actor, and I'm as a director. And this play was given to me by a lady in Palm Springs who wrote it, Joni Ravenna, and who I directed a short play of hers off-Broadway when I was about 10 years ago. And she sent me this play, and I liked it very much. And I thought, well, who's the actor that I would like for this part? And, of course, out of all the actors that I know in the Actors Studio, he was my first choice. And it's been wonderful. He's absolutely great, and you must see this show.
What did he have to do to talk you into being in the show as the star?
Well, actually, I admired him. I know that, as a matter of fact, I remember watching the news in L.A., and he was producing some show with a group of actors, and they were giving it high praise and talking about it. And so that's when I really became aware of him. But as I would see him in the studio, and we'd talk, and we'd talk about, you know, maybe eventually doing something together. And then he came to me with the script. And I looked at it and said, okay. He said, yeah, you know, learn some of it, and we'll try to do it. And to make a long story short, I fell in love with it. I really just started to want to try to really kind of write. I did some writing on it and tried to make it my own. It was so weird when we first tested it to potential investors. Also, Caban Thomas, who the script is about, came, and that was the first time he ever saw me. We did just a little small section of it, and he saw me do that, and he had tears in his eyes. He had to leave the place, and he said, "I couldn't watch it. You're a better actor, a better teacher in this play than I am," which it was a high compliment, but I mean, I know that wasn't really true, but for him to even say that, I thought that was fantastic. And next thing you know, he couldn't come back and watch it anymore. He said it was just too close. And that's amazing. And that's something that he has not been back to see any one of our shows. He just on Facebook blasted, "Go see this show, everybody. This is fantastic." But I'm waiting for the time for him to come to see it himself. And he just he says it's just too close right now.
Well, and that's got to be a really unique experience, meeting somebody who you're doing a play about their life, and it is something that, you know, essentially has changed them, and that it's still, you know, it only happened in 2006 that he was reassigned, quote-unquote, from his professorship at the University of Arkansas. And so do you feel as if that will represent some milestone for him?
I just know that it happened to him, and which was a surprise to me because I thought he would be all in to see someone portraying him on stage. And so actually we said because of that, because I didn't have a lot of interaction with him, a lot of it, this character is really like part of me. I really like, I inhaled this entire project. I mean, once he gave it to me, and I started working on it. I started to take it to the studio, and he says, "Yeah, let's do this." And we would work at the studio. And what's so good about the Actor Studio is anybody could be there. Every week they have something called sessions where they do these scenes in front of everybody, and anybody could be there. You from Oscar winners, Tony winners, you name it. Even the moderator, Martin Landau, won an Oscar. And Mark Rydell, who directed On Golden Pond, he's the other moderator. So it's like, phew, you know, it's a wealth of knowledge there, and they're cutting you up, too.
That's right.
You go in there, you like, you're there, and you're getting ready to do the scene, and you do your scene, and then they sit you down, and there they go. But they say, "Don't worry, we're all friends here." Yeah, but it's not easy sometimes, but they're true in how they really critique you, and it was really helpful when we developed this thing and got this thing to where it is now. They were very helpful, and like I said, I really I took this role to heart. It just, for some reason, I just fell in love with that whole story and situation, and it's finally turned out to be something we think is great.
Now, is this production, or is this part of a larger tour that you're on, or?
We're going to Detroit. He's going to be doing it in Detroit next week. We've done it in Newport Beach. We've done it in Hollywood. We had a run in Hollywood with it, and we plan on hoping to go to a lot of colleges.
It's a new, fresh play. It's like you're seeing something before it gets to Broadway, and that's our goal, Broadway. Yeah. It's not as far as you think. And then we've been getting calls from colleges, and as we were, like, even coming back here, other theaters in L.A. now want us. It's a lot of potential, a lot of stuff, and the fact that it is a college play, all the colleges can relate to this. And you guys were, we're really glad to be here because we just feel this is a natural fit for university and for you guys to see this.
Well, it's actually a little bit eerie because we did have a situation here within about the last month of a professor being reassigned due to some things he said in the classroom. Mm-hmm. So potentially some or all of your audience, when you're at the Payson, is going to be bringing that into the room. Right. In terms of what you bring to the performance and what you bring to the directing, this is for either or both of you to answer. Did you have to have any debate in your own minds? What kind of speech, if any, is too much for the classroom? Did you have to have in your mind an idea of what you would consider too much?
To be honest, I don't feel profanity is what was the thing that was supposedly the thing that got him kicked out. You know, the faculty was saying, well, maybe that's too much, and they were kind of looking for a way to get rid of him. He showed a graphic picture of one of the people he was talking about and teaching about in his classroom, and that kind of was the straw that broke the camel's back.
Right. And that's hard for me to imagine, though, just because those are
historic pictures.
Well,
If you think about it, they were looking for a way to get him out anyway, even though he was so popular with his students. Mm-hmm. For example, this is the first line, and I'll just give it to you, but I'll give you the...
you can give more than the first line, if you want to.
But this is the PG version? But he starts off in his class, good afternoon, class. My name is Caven Thomas, and I'll be your music appreciation professor this semester. But before we begin, for all of those of you who are offended by profanity, I urge you to get the heck out of my class right now. You can imagine what he really said.
You could have said the real thing. She can edit it. He said, get the f*** out of my class. Oh, and that's what, you know.
And that's how it starts off, though. And people were laughing and everything, but the students loved him. And he was just real and raw. But yet he would turn around and say, I was gently disposed of like some rotting piece of garbage that had been overlooked for so long and was now so putrid it was considered toxic. I mean, he mixed street with smart, and it worked, and the students loved it, you know. I just really feel this play, everybody really relate to it, and we tested it in Newport Beach. That was the first time we ever got it on our feet.
Right.
And like I said, I inhaled this piece and worked on it. So at Newport Beach, it was a theater festival there that people basically do readings. And so everybody was kind of reading their projects. Yeah. But I just knew it. I knew it, so I didn't have to. And when I did it and we finished it, and Newport Beach is basically a white audience, rich. Yeah. They're like, you know, the theater goers, but it just seems like they were from another world from where this guy would be.
There were a lot of yachts across the street from them.
Right,
from
a lot
the
of
theater.
Yachts, yep.
It
was beautiful. But they stood up afterwards and gave us a standing ovation for about 10 minutes after the performance. And we were like, oh, okay, we love it. And they said in 13 years, they never gotten a standing ovation for any of their projects.
Right.
And so that's when we felt we had something.
I find myself wondering, if you think about your average Hollywood movie, if you think about your average daily commercial radio talk show, if you think about what gets said off mic in the halls of Congress, the level of general public discourse is not all that clean or kind much of the time. So why is it that the classroom is immune from that kind of usage?
That's interesting.
You have a line in the thing that says talks about that when you can...
You can F a student
yeah.
as long as nobody hears, but don't say the word F.
Do either of you know what he's doing now?
Dubai for a while, I know that.
Yeah, he's doing that. He's just going around now and being... he's teaching. He was teaching there, and he's also, like, trying to perform.
He does some acting.
Uh-huh, but he had a show that he wanted to get out there to kids. And teach them music, and he was working on that. He's still like viable. He's doing a lot of things, you know, and he's a little mysterious too. He's next thing you know, I say he's in Dubai and he's there for a while. Next thing, he's in North Carolina. I said, "Wow, what do you do?" Because he'll email me or Facebook me and let me know. So it's hard to pin him down.
It's interesting, though, that life imitates art. You've got a show where you're playing a teacher, and uh-huh. he's a teacher who has a show.
Right.
And
that's interesting. You're right. Hey, go figure. Life is stranger than fiction, isn't it?
It is amazing.
he has a line in the play that says, "The Cabin Thomas Show. Come and see the play. You'll love it."
Well, T.J. Castronovo and Ernest Hardin, Jr., thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Great. I just want to say it's great to return to Michigan State. I'm an alum.
That's right. Alumnus. We didn't bring that in.
That's right. And they used to nickname me on because I had a radio show called and my radio name was Ern Nitty from the city. So Ern Nitty is back.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, Current State book contributor Scott Southard will have an essay on Banned Book Week. Also, we speak with Christo Rey Community Center's new executive director, Joe Garcia. All that and more Thursday on Current State. I'm Joe Lindstroth, and you've been listening to Current State here on WKAR.